Now, some First Amendment advocates say they're concerned about a series of recent court rulings and lawsuits challenging news outlets. Some of the big cases involve national media organizations like NPR, The New York Times, and Fox News. And the people bringing the lawsuits are challenging the reporting from those outlets, saying it was defamatory or that stories caused emotional distress. The judges overseeing the cases have allowed them to continue. Our next guest says it's fair to ask if this signals a change in how the courts see the media. Jane Curley is a professor of media ethics and law at the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota. She's also former executive director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. Jane, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, up till these recent cases, what was kind of the state of the art when it came to the press being protected from lawsuits over things they may have gotten wrong?
Well, since 1964, when the Supreme Court recognized in a case called New York Times versus Sullivan that public figures, public officials, had a very high burden of proof in order to prevail in a libel case, it's been really difficult for public figures and public officials to win, to even bring the case. And as you said in your opening comments, one of the things that has happened recently is that judges have seemed to be more willing to allow these cases to go past the first hurdle, to survive motions to dismiss or motions for summary judgment and go to trial. That's a big change because after Sullivan and its progeny, cases that followed on from it, most litigants were not successful in taking the case beyond an initial stage, which meant that they never went to trial. Now, in the cases that you enumerated, the courts are saying, yeah, you can go ahead and go to trial. And the risk there for news organizations is in this current climate where so many people are hostile to the press, that means that they're going to basically be at the mercy of juries who may be angry at that particular news outlet or may be angry at the media in general and could show that anger in the kind of judgment they render.
What would the bar have been under that Sullivan decision? If I'm a public figure and I'm trying to sue an outlet for libel, what would I have to establish for it to stand up in court up till these recent cases?
Well, it was a standard called actual malice, which a lot of people think means that the news outlet hated you or something, but that's not what the standard is. It's a legal term of art, and what it means is that the news outlet knew that what it published was false. In other words, that they fabricated it. We might think of it as genuine fake news. Or that they acted recklessly and published the material really without caring whether it was true or false. In other words, they didn't do what a responsible journalist would do to try to verify the accuracy of what they were reporting.
Now, when I look at tabloids as I'm buying groceries, it seems like a lot of headlines would meet that standard of proof. Why don't we see big lawsuits against them more often?
Well, the short answer to that is that those tabloids have very good lawyers who are quite adept at looking at the copy before it is published. They know exactly how far they can go and no further. I think it's interesting that so many of the cases we're talking about right now actually involve what most of us, I think, would think of as mainstream media, media that in general have very good reputations for good quality reporting and for correcting errors when they make them. That's not what we usually think of in the context of the tabloids. I remember years ago there was a case against one of the tabloids where basically, they won the case because they successfully argued that nobody believed what they reported anyway.
Talking to Jane Curley from the University of Minnesota, looking at some court challenges that have First Amendment advocates worried about the press. Let's look at some of these cases now, Jane. One is the New York Times being charged by Sarah Palin, sued by Sarah Palin. Can you remind us what this one's about?
Yes, I'm sure many of us remember when Representative Gabby Giffords was shot in a rampage in Arizona. The Times had done a story later on down the line. Actually, it was an editorial commenting on gun violence in general and had inaccurately said that what had occurred in Arizona was related to something that Sarah Palin's PAC had published. Basically, that they had a graphic that supposedly showed gun or rifle crosshairs over a picture of Gabrielle Giffords. And in fact, her PAC had not done that. And so what was very unusual about this case was the federal district court had a very lengthy hearing prior to any of the decisions about whether they were going to dismiss the case or not, bringing in the guy who was the editorial page editor, a guy named James Bennett, and basically interrogated him about what he had done. The Court of Appeals panel said that ultimately he had not made a sufficient case, that he had made the error in good faith, and that the case could go forward to trial.
And it's important to note that the case has not been decided. The significant difference here is that it has gone to trial, where often in the past it might not have. Is that right?
That's exactly it. I mean, it's also very interesting that the court in New York decided to have this initial hearing, which was fairly lengthy and I would say quite intrusive into sort of the mindset of what the news organization had done. And I think we can't discount the fact that having to mount a defense in that kind of hearing is expensive, it's time consuming, it deflects journalists from their real work. So even if ultimately they win, the threat of something like this can have an impact on the kind of choices you make about the kind of journalism you'll do.
And one concern is, okay, if you're talking a national news organization, they may also have good lawyers and maybe fairly deep pockets. But for, say, a regional news outlet or a city news outlet, we know times are not so great for them. Is there a fear that if lawsuits go ahead more often, it could put these out of business since they can't afford to even mount a successful case?
In fact, that's already happened in a couple of instances. There was a case many years ago involving a newspaper in Belleville, Illinois, that was bankrupted over something that it actually never even published in their newspaper. It was in basically an internal memo that got out. This is a genuine concern today because even news organizations that we think of as longstanding and fairly wealthy cannot just idly take on the threat of a huge libel defense. As I said, even if they win and or there's not a huge judgment against them, it's still very expensive to defend themselves in cases like this. And under the American system, it's unlikely that they would be able to recover attorney's fees and costs even if they win.
There was a law or regulation called the SLAPP. I think it's strategic lawsuits against public participation. I don't know if I have that exactly right. But the idea is, all right, we're going to limit lawsuits that are made, in effect, just to bankrupt the target of the lawsuit, whatever the details of the case. Has that been a factor in past press lawsuit efforts?
It's interesting because the anti-SLAPP laws originally were designed to protect what was called public participation. And so it really wasn't aimed at news organizations. It was more for activists or even just citizens who would like stand up in a meeting and denounce somebody in government or a big corporation or something like that. And of course, those people would have much more limited resources. But after a few years, in most states, the courts that have had a chance to look at the SLAPP law, have said no reason why this can't apply to news organizations. So at least in some jurisdictions, we've actually got rulings that affirmatively say these laws can protect reporters from nuisance lawsuits or suits that are really designed, as you said, to bankrupt their news organization.
We're talking to Jane Curtley, professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota, about three recent court rulings that are causing some concern for First Amendment watchers in lawsuits targeting big media outlets. We'll check out a couple more stories about NPR News and Fox News coming up. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of all this? Should it be easier for someone to sue a media outlet, or should there be continue to be a high bar to protect press freedom? It doesn't matter if it's a public figure, an elected official, say, at the center of the question. And what questions do you have about all this stuff works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation about the courts and the relationship with the press. Jane Curtley is with us from the University of Minnesota, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the courts letting some lawsuits against the media move forward? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go to our caller, Jane, I want to check out the other two cases. They're all kind of connected to a related issue. This next one is NPR and an investment advisor from Texas over NPR's reporting on Seth Rich. So we'll note here we are an NPR affiliate. It's a little complicated what's going on here.
Well, I mean, the most, I think, the gist of it is that Rod Wheeler basically is suing NPR because he claims that they inaccurately reported on some public legal filings in connection with this investigation into the death of Seth Rich. What the judge said was that the NPR report, although it was based on the public legal filings, basically implied that Wheeler had committed some kind of wrongdoings. And this is, and also implied basically that he had done something wrong. This is a significant ruling, in my opinion, even though, as you have said before, it's not the final ruling in the case. And it reflects what's going on in a number of places, including right now in Minnesota, where the courts are looking at what we call the fair report privilege, which is the right to accurately report without fear of being sued the contents of official documents like court filings. And I'm very concerned about this because this has been an extremely important protection, not just for the press, but for the public, because I think we have a right to know what government is up to, what they're saying in their reports, what's being filed in court filings. And this case does raise the question of whether, even if you accurately report what's there, you might be vulnerable to a lawsuit like this one.
And the person involved, Ed Butowski, he had funded some of these investigations. Is there some question over whether he constitutes a public figure for his participation in this?
That's the other piece of this case that is concerning. Courts have obviously taken different approaches in defining who is a public figure and who is not. The original New York Times versus Sullivan case dealt with a public official, but later cases expanded that to include public figures. Some people are quite happy to say, yes, I'm a public figure, but of course if you do that, that means you have to prove actual malice. So many people fight very hard not to be classified as a public figure. I personally think that he would fall under the category of a public figure, but the tricky part is that sometimes you can argue that if you're only public because of the false and defamatory information that was published about you, that doesn't make you a public figure for the purposes of actual malice.
And then the third case you were watching involves Fox News and the family of Seth Rich. Walk us through this one.
Well, this is one where after the whole Seth Rich theory started being floated, Fox basically, allegedly, according to the parents of Seth Rich, conspired with Mr. Butowski in order to concoct and publish false reports about the dealings that the son had with WikiLeaks, because the idea of this particular conspiracy theory is that he was one of the sources of the Democratic National Committee emails that found their way to WikiLeaks. Essentially, what the family is arguing is that they conspired to make up fake news. And the judges in this case, in a circuit that's usually quite protective of the news media, said that it was at least plausible that this had happened, and so a jury would ultimately have to be the finders of fact to decide whether it did or not.
Talking to Jane Kirtley, professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota, looking at some cases involving the media, cases moving ahead in the courts where they might not have just a few years ago. Let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. Dave is with us in Menominee. Dave, hi.
Hello.
What do you think?
Well, I think the media should be 100% the people in that do the media, reporters. They better make sure they get things 100% accurate, because look what's going on in this country right now. What happened to this Russian trying to interfere with our election when they found out that wasn't going to go nowhere? It took a year and a half and $20 million. Now we're right back in it again with this whistleblower. And is this really happened, or is this something they made up again? I mean, this is stuff like this has to end. It has to end, because look what it's doing to this country.
Dave, thanks for the call. Of course, Russia did interfere with our election. That was the conclusion of the Mueller report and most intelligence agencies. The whistleblower report does appear to actually exist. But Jane, to his point that he wants to see the media make sure they get everything right, how liable is the media when they just make a mistake?
Well, I mean, here's the important thing. The news media, whoever we're talking about, whether it's Fox News, CNN, NPR, whatever, they publish, you know, thousands, if not millions, of facts in any given year. And the odds that they'll get some of them wrong are incredibly high. No matter how careful you are, you can mess up. It is, you know, journalists just, professional journalists just hate it when they make mistakes. And the thing that tells you, I think, that they're acting professionally is if they move as promptly as they can to correct those mistakes. I know we'd like to have infallibility in our public institutions as well as in the media, but that's really not realistic. So for me, the test is, did they act as you know, responsibly as they could in publishing the information and collecting the data, and do they correct it when they make a mistake? And again, this goes to the actual malice standard, because if you were not acting recklessly, if you were not deliberately publishing a falsehood, then the likelihood is that you're going to be protected. You know, President Trump has talked about opening up the libel laws because he thinks that the current standards provide too much protection to the press. But as the Supreme Court said back in 1964, we have to be able to allow journalists to make errors in good faith, because otherwise they'll censor themselves and the public will get less information.
Let's talk about who the media protections apply to. I know Alex Jones and his website and various media operations have been sued in part due to claims he's made about the Sandy Hook shooting and others. Is he a media outlet in terms of the legal protections?
That's such a great question, because the interesting thing is that the Supreme Court has never in any of its court opinions actually defined who the press is. And of course, 1964, that's what we talked about. We didn't talk about the media, it was the press. And I think the reason is that for many, many years, we didn't have to, because you basically looked at what people were doing. Were they gathering information to disseminate to the public? And if they were, then they fell under the banner of the news media or the press. We've never licensed news organizations in this country. I mean, yes, television stations get FCC licensing, but individual journalists do not. And that's viewed as something that would actually violate the First Amendment if we tried to do it. The problem now is that anybody who has access to the internet or to social media, digital media, can be engaging in things that look like journalism. And so I think it is becoming more complicated to answer that question, but to answer your specific question, I would say yes, he would be subject to the same protections that the New York Times would be.
Now, talk about libel laws. I understand that in some countries, including the UK, the things are very different. The standards for libel are very different. How do they compare, and what effect do you see that having on the media?
Well, they are different, and of course, as more and more American companies are really publishing literally all over the world, they have to pay attention to this. Basically, I would say that in many other countries, they default more to the idea that we have people have a right to protect their reputations. And it's not that we don't have that right here. It's just that when it's balanced against the First Amendment protections of the press, which, again, the public will benefit from, that oftentimes, unless it's a deliberate attempt to fabricate, make something up, or to act really recklessly, we have to protect the journalist's right to publish in order to protect the public right. That really isn't the view in many other countries. And in fact, because it's so different elsewhere, Congress passed a law some years ago called the Speech Act, which basically says that if you get a libel judgment in another country that has a law that's less protective than the law here, you can't enforce that judgment in the United States. You can't come into court here and make them pay, because it would violate the First Amendment interests that again, we all benefit from.
Do you see other cases like that one, or other instances that point in the other direction from the cases we've been talking about, that point toward stronger protections for the press?
Well, I would say not so much stronger protections, but that we're maintaining the status quo. Again, I think the Speech Act that I just mentioned is a great example of how even Congress was ready to say it's important to protect freedom of the press. And there have been several other cases. Even somebody like BuzzFeed has been successful in fending off a lawsuit that was brought by a Russian entrepreneur who said he was defamed. And there have been several other very strong pro-press rulings that have come out of the Sixth Circuit, for example, in Cincinnati. And you know, I guess I would say the sky is not falling at this point, but I think there are some cracks in the ceiling in the sense that I think judges are becoming a little more skeptical of the idea that journalists are operating in good faith and that they make their mistakes in good faith. I think this endless drumbeat of fake news is having an effect. And while, you know, there may be people out there that are deliberately publishing things they know aren't true with the intent to deceive, I don't think that applies to mainstream media in this country.
In our last minute or so, how do you think the mainstream media can respond?
Well, I think we just got to do a better job, obviously, of doing our work, being truthful, accurate, and correcting mistakes when we make them, but also educating the public and reminding them how important a free press really is. It's the cornerstone of our republic, of our democracy, however you want to define it. And without it, we really are hobbled in the sense of trying to hold government accountable.
Jane, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
That's Jane Curtley, media ethics and law professor from the University of Minnesota. She was with us today to talk about recent libel or defamation lawsuits involving the media that she says could signal a change in the way the courts see the press and its First Amendment protections.